Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. This is my console, and the spotlight is Dan Conover, author of seven novels, including such titles as another goddamn novel about the collapsing quantum multiverse, and the Goddess-Daughter Trilogy, among others. He's also a Tar Heel. He hails from Greensboro, North Carolina, a lovely town that I've been to. Having lived in Charlotte, North Carolina, I'm quite familiar with the Tar Heel state. As it isn't called actually statewide, but he also graduated from the University of North Carolina, further immersing himself in Tar Heel culture. He's a former tank commander in the U.S. military. He has a piece of shrapnel in his left earlobe to this day that serves as, you know, a piercing and an ornament on holidays. In addition to that, I mean, on a more peaceful front, he's a former reporter and bureau chief with various newspapers, news organizations, you name it. In 2008, after working as a freelancer and media consultant for several years, he launched a media services company named Arctopia LLC. He did that along with his wife, Jana Edens, who is also a writer and a graphic designer. The list of activities and accomplishments in Dan Conover's bio goes on. We haven't even gotten into his wife's ancestral farm in South Carolina, now operating under the moniker Black Sheep Manor Gardens. You know, that black sheep part sounds like Eric Prince has a stake in it, but then Manor Gardens sounds so pastoral. This man is a bundle of contradictions, as you'll learn as we go along here. Dan Conover, patriot, insurgent, gentleman farmer, and now full-time novelist. Welcome to the program.
Mike, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And yeah, having looked at your website, having read your bio, having looked at sampled your various novels, I was really interested in getting into some depth here with you. Let's start, though, with kind of some of the things that may have set the table for your writing career. You were a tank commander. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you were in charge of a single tank?
Yes.
Or a battalion or a company?
No.
Or what?
No, I was a sergeant. I made sergeant in the 2nd Armored Cavalry while I was in Germany. But the rank didn't catch up to me till I got to Texas for my second stint. And they're like, wait a minute, why are you wearing the wrong rank? I'm like, well, nobody told me. But I'd been, as it worked out, we just were short sergeants in Germany. And so my first stint as a tank commander was before I made sergeant, which is not supposed to happen, but we just ran out of people that could read a map and run a tank. So,
how many guys are in a tank?
Four.
Is it Abrams? Were you an Abrams
tank? Yeah, the original Abrams tank. And then I was on the second Abrams tank as a gunner with the big 120 millimeter gun, which is makes a big bang. I have bad hearing.
Exactly. I mean, I haven't heard it live, but I've definitely heard it recorded and so on.
It's a rush.
You may or may not be a militaristic guy. I know that you used the GI Bill. Was this part of a plan that you go to the military, serve your country, and in return you get that GI Bill, you got your college education? Was that all part of the plan? Or were you kind of a gung-ho, go U.S., are you my country right or wrong sort of guy back when you were a youngster?
No, I don't think I've ever been that person. I basically went to college on the GI Bill, on the Pell Grant originally at App State. And that was great. I had a fantastic education there until they cut the federal Pell Grant program. And there was just no way that I could go to college. So, I wound up, I dropped out in December and I was in the Army in October.
Okay. And how many years did you do? Four years. So the big heavy equipment and all that. Does your military experience, I mean, we draw from so many things when we're writers. Does your military experience inform your writing at all?
I think everything we ever do does. So yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the, in the, this fourth book in this, this series called The Darbus Cycle, which is constructed of trilogies. So this starts the second trilogy after The Goddess Daughter. One of the characters is a career Army sergeant. So, you know, the way that I know that, that I'm getting him right is that he's saying things that Army sergeants that I know would say. And if I try to make him say something that they wouldn't say, he tells me.
He rebels.
Yes, he does.
He tells you, give me 20.
I would not. I'm not saying that, dude. Okay, God, what would you say? Okay, fine, go. Because it really is sort of like, it really is sort of like running a theater company in your head. And they are supposed to, speak, but sometimes they rebel against the lines that you're writing for.
A theater company. So let me ask you, have you ever been writing a novel and said, you know, I got too many characters. This is going to be too chaotic. It's going to be too hard to keep track of them. And I'm going to confuse the reader. Has that happened? Or are you the guy, kind of guy who tends to keep clean lines, minimum characters, clean lines with a really strong authorial voice? What would you say?
That's a great question. I don't know. I will say this, that the, you know, basically you have your protagonists, antagonists, you have your important characters that drive the plot. And then you have people that are essentially just sort of part of the, they're either part of the plot or somebody that would be in the scene if you were staging the scene. I don't think that I have too many characters. What I think is that when you are plotting out a book or a series of books that is supposed to be, you know, 15 books, you have to keep track of everything, including characters and their names and their birth dates and all kinds of ridiculous trivia. So that's a big part of the process. It's just not the fun part.
Because these are characters who you're using on a continuing basis. I mean, would you say, let's take a guy like Carl Hiaasen out of Florida. He brings back characters, especially that crazy former governor. I forget his name, but you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
The guy with the with the fake eye. Mm-hmm. He has a glass eye and all that. So, but then on the other hand, you have all kinds of different writers who that this is my detective and that detective Travis McGee is in John D. McDonald's novels, almost all of them. So, is it that sort of thing, or do you have more of an ensemble of characters?
This is an ensemble cast.
And so you've already plotted, you've got seven novels and you plotted, but you mentioned 15. So you're plotted out for 15.
Yeah. So basically I've just now finished the fourth of the, actually, let me step back for a second. So what originally happened was that I wrote up the first book that I ever wrote was out of this world, this Darbus continent world. And, I thought it was pretty good. It was a near miss story in terms of it being published by an actual publishing house. And then I just had to go back to being a newspaper editor and reporter. And I didn't get to do much with that until years later. And, you know, I thought, I really kind of like this world. I think there's stuff I could do in that. I'm going to write a prequel. And so what I've done is I've taken that first book that I wrote, which I later broke into two and submitted again years later, trying to get an agent. You know, I've taken those. Those were things that I published as ebooks. I've pulled them back, and they're going to be basically written through. They'll be the third trilogy in this series. So, you know, basically I'm giving myself the time to develop that story in that world. In a generation before that book, before that third trilogy, which is
so been a these lot are of trilogies, fun. Trilogies within a bigger body of work,
right? And so, in terms of what that means from a structural point, from a planning point, is that every book has to have its own book arc. It also has to have its trilogy arc, and then it has to have a series arc. And so keeping all of
you don't make things easy for yourself.
I don't. I suppose I don't. I could make it a lot easier. But this one, it sort of took over.
Well, let me ask you this. So you've got this ensemble of characters, and I can see to where they've become very intimate to you, and you know them very well. Their lives, their personalities continue to unfold. The experiences are there. But does that fire you up, or do you get to a point, or have you ever had even a passing thought that, you know, I'm getting sick of these people? I'd like to just go and create a whole new ensemble of folks.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. I can tell you that I had an absolute blast writing the first this Goddess Daughter trilogy. I enjoy writing books in the first place, so that's not an issue. But once I found the thread, that was just I really like these people, and I think that's generally a good marker for how the readers will find them. If you're having fun with the characters and they seem real to you, I think that's probably a pretty good indicator. I'm not bored with any of them, and in fact, I'm just the only issue I've got right now is just waiting on. Right now, I'm waiting on my editor, who's really been who's taken off and gotten more clients, and so all of a sudden, I'm having to wait on her.
Oh boy! Yeah, it happens. So let me ask you about what does inform your writing most. The military, has its place. It's like anything else that happens in life. You're not going to write the next Catch-22. That's not what you're interested in. No major in your book. But what about other influences you've had in your life? Is there anything that really stands out?
Well, it's absolutely that's
been number one.
I mean, being a newspaper man for 20 years, boy, that's a world, you know, and you know, the, absolutely strikes me that once you've being a newspaper man, and I use that in rather than just journalist, used to mean that you had access to all sorts of parts of life that most people don't get to ever really get close to. They might get close to one thing, but I mean, I was a city editor for a long time. And so even when it wasn't my reporting that I was doing, I was working with 37 reporters and editors, all of whom were working on stories. And I had to be embedded mentally in everything they were doing because that's what my job was, making decisions about those things. It's this incredible education if you're lucky enough to get it. And I don't know that I haven't been in the business now for quite a while, so I'm not sure what it's like now. But back then, it was the best training that a writer could ever get because you're writing or editing every single day, hours and hours. So you're getting in your 10,000 hours really fast. But
it's a different kind of writing.
Oh, it is. But it is. I've always enjoyed writing fiction. I wrote fiction before I became a newspaper guy. Honestly, you know, I figured coming out of college when I had to drop out of college the first time, I just figured I'd go back and get a degree in English because all I ever really wanted to do was write. And I thought that's just what you did. But being in the Army made me realize, one of the jobs I had in Germany, I was what was called a border operator. And we patrolled the Czech and East German borders. That was really fun. I loved doing it. And so I wound up having that as part of my job, was running these patrols on the border. And by the time I came back from that experience with the pressures and the deadlines and the just kind of the excitement of going out and looking at things like this, I just couldn't see myself just being in a university setting for the rest of my life. So
were you writing when you were in the military?
I was.
Did you have time and you were drawing off of, okay. So interesting. So I will say that when it comes to newspaper writing, I think the handicap it creates in people writing fiction, and you had an advantage in that you were writing fiction before you were doing the newspaper stuff. But I find myself that it tends to create situations where I'm inclined to over-explain things.
Oh, yeah.
And to be overly structured. And it's kind of like, you know, when you're writing fiction, you need to leave some breathing room for the reader. You need to let them fill in some blanks. You need to let them sketch out some of the, you know, whether the physicality of the people or the landscape or the urban settings and, mm-hmm. And whatnot. So I find that I tend to over describe and also just feel like I've got to fill everything out. And it's like, you don't need to do that.
Well, that's where editing comes in, Mike.
Yeah.
You know, where you edit yourself.
But it also kind of, well, you want to do a good first draft. Well, not necessarily a first draft, but you want to do a good finished draft anyway. And it takes some of the joy out of writing fiction. It almost defeats the purpose because a lot of people who are in the writing business go to fiction thinking there's freedom there. And unless you allow that freedom to actually assert itself, then it's kind of like defeats the purpose. Let me ask you this.
Well, I'm going to jump in real quick.
Sure.
You brought up Carl Hyacin before. Newspaper yeah. guy. Another newspaper yes. guy. SV Date. Another Florida newspaper guy. What do they have in common? Well, they've got this very tuned ear for humor and absurdity, and they came out of that Florida realm where, I mean, Florida is just a strange place. And, you know, so I think that it can be, and I know several newspaper people who I think are really good at writing fiction. But to your point, I absolutely, particularly in this book that I just finished, found myself going back on that first draft and going, okay, we're not going to grade this for accuracy and the completeness of everything. We're going to cut that down. And that's where,
self-editing
is my favorite part of writing, by the way, is when I've got that first draft done and now I get to do my first read and I get to write through the whole story instead of constructing.
How much editing do you do as you write? Because that's one of the real Achilles tendons of writers is that they don't allow themselves to really just let it flow. They judge every word, phrase, and sentence.
So I try to keep the flow as the primary focus in that I understand when I'm writing that first draft that I'm building the story that I'm then going to have the freedom to work with. The only time that I really stop moving forward and go back and fix something is when it won't let me sleep at night, right? I know that I can always come back at the end and do it, but in some instances, it's just so irritating to me that I missed that beat or, mm-hmm. I just need to go back and fix it, and I'll do that. But generally, you get to the end, that's when the some of the best writing takes place, is when you've got a complete story. And now it's like, well, what did I miss while I was pushing forward?
You know, when I read your writing, I'm reminded of one of my favorite novelists, former newspaper man, in fact, Tom Robbins, as in another roadside
yeah,
attraction
yeah,
and
me
half
too.
Asleep in frog pajamas yeah. and so on. Is he counted among your influences?
You know, he's from Blowing Rock, of all places.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Blowing Rock, North Carolina, for you listeners who are not familiar with the geography there.
Right. And I, of course, it was at App State in Boone, which is, this is back when you couldn't get beer in Boone back in the 80s. So we all would go up to Blowing Rock for a beer. But yeah, I absolutely loved Robbins when I was a college student. One of the things that I saw.
I see it in your writing because your writing is really flamboyant and energetic. And that's the way Tom Robbins, those are just two of the characteristics, but certainly he's known for his flamboyance. He's known for energetic writing and wild characters.
Wild characters. And, you know, the one book where I felt like I got to indulge that Robbins energy was the book that I wound up calling Another Goddamn Novel About the Collapsing Quantum Multiverse. Because it was, I just finished this big contract as a consultant and best money I'd ever made. And I did two things with that other than pay the bills and pay some kids' college tuitions. I bought my wife and I some camping equipment. And then the second thing that I did was I said, I'm going to take a month and I'm going to write a book that I'll never have to worry about publishing. I'm just going to have fun doing it. And that was that. I broke every rule of fiction writing that I could think of in writing that book. And a few years.
And this is a multiverse one.
Yes. And I had so much fun doing that.
And you did publish it. So it actually worked for you.
But I never submitted it to an agent. I never considered submitting it to an agent.
Did you think that no agent will accept it because it's too out there?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I'm somebody, to be clear about it, I really wanted that traditional publishing experience. Mm-hmm. And, didn't want to let it go. And I don't want to talk bad about it, because that's, you know, I'm entirely aware that could just be very sour grapey on my part. But I also understand that the industry's in flux. I've talked to people who, you know, had friends that were published novelists, and, heard from them the kinds of issues that they had. So right now I see that there's a path for doing the thing that I want to do, which is just doing this and having it pay for itself, through doing this independent route. So I'm doing that. And so far so good, but, it means that I have to do things that I don't like doing, like, promoting and, you know, getting good at advertising, but mm-hmm. it also means that I get to call the shots.
Right.
It's pretty good.
And the residuals are bigger.
That's correct.
Unless you're big time, unless you sell really big numbers, traditional publishing companies give you a very thin slice of the pie.
I can't prove this, but from what I have gathered, I would wager that if there aren't more people who are actually making a living self-publishing right now than people who are being published the traditional route, that day will come soon.
Interesting. So who else influenced your fiction writing? Tom Robbins is one of them. Give us a few other people who you really like and you feel like helped to form your own voice.
So, like, one of the things that you hear a lot when you talk to people who write fantasy and science fiction is a story that goes like this. Oh, I grew up in a traditional home, yada, yada. And then I discovered amazing stories. And it was like this incredible thing. And I love to go read this magazine, or I discovered this science fiction writer. And it was like, you know, it's always like this flash in the dark and this sense of a forbidden pleasure. I've discovered science fiction and fantasy. With me, it was the exact opposite, because I grew up in a home where there were lots of books, and almost all of them, all the adults in my world who read, their primary thing that they read was science fiction, fantasy mixed in there. And so I grew up and I had probably read hundreds of books, the science fiction and fantasy books, by the time I was a young teen. And so the thing that really kind of changed me was, at some point I stumbled across a really lesser, not very good book by John Steinbeck called The Moon Is Down. And for whatever reason, I just got really interested in Steinbeck. And so by the time I was probably 15 or 16, I'd read just about everything he'd ever written.
What made him so interesting to you? I mean, I know he writes beautifully, but it just captured you. Because you don't write anything like Steinbeck. I mean, your writing is a completely different style.
Right. I honestly don't know what it was. I liked his sensibilities. I loved his I loved the characters in books like Cannery Row. A Tortilla Flat. I mean, some of those books are not really well read now, and he clearly, when I got to college, I was surprised at how out of fashion Steinbeck was among the few people that I knew in the literature department. But
you can't go wrong with Steinbeck, though.
He was formative to me, and at 14, I knew I wanted to be a writer because I really enjoyed reading Steinbeck, and I read through the standard sort of what used to be the canon of sort of mid-century 20th American novelists and whatnot. But I also ran into Kerouac when I was about 16, and On the Road was a big thing to me.
I hear Douglas Adams out there somewhere.
Did read Douglas Adams, but not until college. I'll tell you that the person, so I'd just gotten remarried, was living in Charleston with my wife and our four kids. And we lived next door to the library and public library in Charleston, and we'd go there because we didn't have any money. So we'd take the kids to the library. And, I just picked up this book, looked kind of interesting to me, called Flanders by a writer named Patricia Anthony, who was a science fiction writer. And Patricia had won, I can't remember which, she won some awards for her first book and then a book called Brother Termite. But she was kind of a cult favorite. I didn't know anything. I'd never heard of her. And the problem for her was that she wanted to tell stories that didn't fit neatly into boxes. And anyway, I read this book, Flanders, which I won't bother to try to describe now, other than say it's a book about World War I. It involves a psychic soldier in the trenches. It made me cry. and when I was done with it, I'm like, I just love this book. And I did something I never done before. And I just wrote her a letter. And she wrote me back. And we got to be... I never met her. She lived in Dallas. I was working in Charleston. We talked a lot, and because I really valued that friendship, I never leaned on her to help me try to build a career. She was at that point basically just making her money off of James Cameron kept optioning her books. She was working. She was an adjunct at Southern Methodist, I think. But she was the bravest, most bawdy, fearless person I think I'd ever met. She refused to do what they wanted her to do in terms of stick within the science fiction genre. And eventually her publisher just said, we can't be your publisher anymore because you're not writing something that fits into science fiction anymore. And so she described herself as being slipstream.
Interesting.
And I decided that, all right, this series, this Darbus cycle is fantasy, but it's kind of science fiction. And then it falls by the alleged rules of fantasy lit. I think it falls very clearly into the subgenre of epic fantasy. It just has different sensibilities, and it just kind of goes outside of what people, it just doesn't stick to the form in a way that a publisher would be real comfortable with, maybe. But Patricia would be, I think Patricia would be proud that I got here, and that's what matters to me. She died a few years ago. Yeah, but I could talk about
Kurt Vonnegut was always put in science fiction. He didn't really see himself as science fiction. No. You could read, when I would read Douglas Adams, it would start out with some science fiction, would end with science fiction, but everything in between was just a regular, hysterically funny novel with great characters.
Yeah.
And I think Ray Bradbury said, I wrote one science fiction book and everybody's called me science fiction ever since.
That's great. I didn't know that. That's a good one. Yeah, I mean.
No, that's not an exact quote, but he was just saying, I'm not really science fiction. I write about everything. I did one and now everybody's labeled me science fiction. Well, it worked for him. So no complaint there. It worked for Kurt Vonnegut, worked for Douglas Adams. So let me ask you to describe. Before I'm going to ask you to read a little bit, but before you do that, describe your writing voice. How would you describe that if you were to maybe pick some adjectives out that would define it?
Oh, man.
I know it's not an easy question.
No, it's a great question. I just haven't ever thought of that before. In terms of, I think I'm kind of a natural smartass. And I think part of that is that I want to talk about. I wind up thinking about serious things entirely too much because I'm a newspaper guy, I think. And there are some big questions about who, I covered politics for a long time, and what I have had to face up to is that what I thought people were, what we thought people were in a democracy, was a lot more rational than people have turned out to be.
Oh yeah, and for sure.
And that is, you could just leave it there. For me, that means that that some of my assumptions about the better angels of our nature are probably something that I have to reconsider. And that's very difficult for me to even say. So I think one of the ways that I deal with trying to think about hard questions is to try to think about them with a sense of, maybe my voice is a little askew, maybe it's a little smart ass, maybe it's humor is important when you're staring down the barrel of something as dark as what our future looks like. And I'll just say this about the series that I'm working on. I think that a lot of science fiction is fairly near term, right? And right now what we're facing is a series of interconnected problems that I just refer to as the 21st century bottleneck, because they're all arriving at the same time. Overpopulation is kind of driving, or the overpopulation, I should just say, population is driving most of them. And that includes global warming. Just the number of people, even if we are not, even if we're not expanding our carbon footprint, when you add new people, it just is going to require more energy. And we haven't been able to solve that problem. So,
meanwhile, the projections are that we're going to start losing global population. It's like, when is it going to get here? Because we're supposed to like top out at 9 billion and then start to see the decline.
Not clear
but
that
we're
going
to. Are we going to get there or not?
We're at 7 and a half.
How long is this going to take?
So, the thing that I've found is I don't want to write that sort of standard apocalyptic fiction, dystopian stuff. When you look at what the premise of the Darby cycle is that this is a far future world, whether it's Earth or not, I never say, it doesn't matter, right? What it is this is a civilization that's trying to get started again after much more advanced civilizations have come and gone, not just one, but several. So it's looking back instead of looking ahead, which can be just, I think, I really like that idea because it lets me write about the kinds of problems that a civilization like ours is going to face, from the perspective of people who are trying to look back and understand what that was, to where those things are far enough removed that they enter into the realm of myth instead of being so explicit. Because, God, we've all had it with the explicitness of these problems. It's just easier for me to write about it in a way that I feel like, without having to be, that I can have a little fun with it without it just being that sort of grinding sadness when, every time that I see something beautiful defiled in the world, it's sad. And I could be depressed about that, or I could try to find a way to be at peace with it and bring something out of it.
Yep. No, I get it. I get it. Why don't you go ahead and read a sample from one of your novels? Which one would you pick? And something emblematic of your writing so that people kind of, it's like, hey, if I'm going to read Dan Conover, this is the kind of stuff I'm going to get. Let's see if I like it.
Well, let me just do this one. This is just this is one from Shane. I'm going to pause and do a Mark Rubio and drink a little water first, though.
Sure. Go right ahead. Use two hands when you do it. Otherwise, it won't count.
Glug, glug, glug. All right, here we go. This is from Shane. This is Shane.
I hope our listeners are politically aware so they know that I just made a joke. I go, two hands? What are you talking
What's
about?
What are talking about? okay, so this is a scene where Shane has just run afoul of the sheriff in a place called Cerdwin. I wasn't out for long, But to be honest about it, when you've just been knocked unconscious by a leather truncheon stuffed with damp sand, it isn't the length of time you spend out of your head that matters. Whether you've been down for a few minutes or a few hours, when you open your eyes again, it's not good. Sheriff Cade sat in a stiff back chair with her feet up on a stool. She was flanked by two female guards dressed in standard cotton shirts and trousers, but festooned with those showy red sashes. The male jailer I'd braced for the treatment of Brother Zephyr hovered in near the open door to the sheriff's office. "So you're the famous Shane Vicar," Cade began, her grin surprisingly wide for such a narrow little figure. "Congratulations. You're the first formerly dead person I've ever had to place under arrest." "You hit me in the back of the head," I said. "Actually, she did," Cade said, pointing to the mannish-looking woman on her right, who smiled and wagged the kosh she'd used on me, a 4-inch pouch of braided leather that flopped back and forth at the end of a short wooden handle like some flaccid, malicious penis. I tried to sit up straighter in the chair where I found myself, but the movement came too quickly, and I winced and relented. "Why did she hit me in the back of the head?" "Resisting lawful detention," Cade said, leaning forward and smiling even wider. "I just placed you under arrest for contempt, and what did you take and do?" "Resisted," the big deputy said. The other two underlings in the room nodded in agreement. "I'm not a tall, strong woman like you, Shane," Cade said. "I'm not particularly smart like they say you are. I'm not truly superlative in any particular way, although I was born into an excellent family. But here's the secret to my success. People don't generally piss down my leg more than once. You get my meaning?" "No," I said, closing my eyes and trying to make my head stop throbbing. "I really don't. I mean that when I tell a person what I'm going to do, I do it. I'm a little woman, Shane. I don't have the luxury of letting people take an inch or here or there. They have to understand that I offer only one warning, not two, not ever." "You didn't offer me a warning," I moaned. "Marm, when the sheriff says you're under arrest, that constitutes your one warning," said the big guard. "You were warned. Everybody in Saradwin knows that, Shane," Cade said. "Well, that could be the problem here," I said. "See, I'm new in town." "Yes, you are," she said, taking her feet down off the stool and rearranging herself in the chair. "In fact, you're so new to town, you haven't even bothered to figure out how things work around here yet." And I could keep going, but that's about...
Which novel is that?
That's Shane, the first novel.
Oh, that's the title. Mm-hmm. It's written in first person. Yeah. Do you write everything in first person or not?
No, I do not. So Shane, the conceit of Shane is that this is a person, we don't actually say why yet, but this is a person of some significance who wrote a famous memoir that was published in 3 volumes, and this is the centennial edition of that memoir that has been just sort of redone for a modern audience by a new generation. And so that lets her have a first person voice, but it also helps me with the problem of, when you're writing if you're actually writing a memoir for an audience of one, like she was, you wouldn't necessarily include the proper context that you would need in a fantasy novel. So in this case, I kind of black box that by saying, okay, but we've come through as a history department here, and we've written in the context that makes it accessible to the modern reader, which was a fun way to write because it gave me the ability to see the world through her eyes. But what I'm doing now in this second trilogy is basically 20 years after the events in Shane, and the things that were set in motion in that book are now something that I'm exploring through 3 novels that can basically stand on their own, that tell the story of this slide into war from the perspectives of 3 very different cultures, 3 very different third-person limited protagonists. And when I go to the third book in the series, or the third trilogy in the series, that's going to be 3 books where it's got that sort of Michael Shara changing POV every chapter, which works wonderfully when you're trying to tell a story about conflict and in that case, war.
Well, you also made a important point there about it's a trilogy, you have a few trilogies now, but each of them can stand on their own. In other words, somebody can read it and not feel like I have no idea what's going on. I'm lost. I have no context.
Won't be true when you get to book trilogy number three. From trilogy number three on, it will be very difficult to just pick up. But, you know, that's I think once you get into any of the longer series, that's going to be a challenge. I'll try to make it as accessible as I can, but once you get, 10 books in, it's really hard to get all of that without having some sense of it. Now, I try to take one of the things is, I think that I've kind of lucked into a trend that's working, which is that, I'd already planned to do this as a series, but now that I'm in the indie world, I can see that people who are making a living tend to be people who are writing series and finding an audience that wants to be in that world is a decent business plan if you can find that audience.
Yep. Yeah, I get it. Absolutely. Well, genre writing tends to work that way.
I think so.
And you've got this ensemble of characters. So this question would be a difficult one for most writers, but I think it's probably going to be easier for you because I want to ask you who your favorite character is. And since you're working with that same set of characters, at least the core set of characters you've got, who's your favorite character?
Well, I mean,
that you've created.
I'll just say for writing them. it's hard to beat your villains. I think that I'm a generally handicapped by being a person that would like to do the right thing, whatever that thing is. I don't always know, but I would like to do the right thing. Well, that's kind of restrictive, but there's a freedom in a truly amoral villain who thinks in this case she's doing the right thing. She's trying to do, what she thinks is best, but she's also lost the thread to the point where she's capable of doing absolutely anything. And, at one point in the trilogy near the end, she just loves winning so much that I didn't plan on doing this, but she just breaks into a spontaneous dance because it's just physically so pleasurable for her to win. And I'm like, I didn't see that coming. But yeah, she would do that.
Now, your wife Janet is a graphic designer, yes, among other things. Mm-hmm. So, has she designed your book covers at all?
She's designed all of the book covers in the Darbus trilogy, and she did. So, if you go, I've got a new cover on another goddamn novel, which was written as. Oh, by the way, I should point out so. I've got two novels that you can buy right now on Amazon written by Dan Conover. I've got three novels on Amazon plus a pre-order that you can buy under the name D.C. McElroy, which is the name that I created just to segregate the truly fantasy genre stuff. And that has nothing to do with, I'm very transparent about that. It's just the thing where Amazon and hopefully I'll eventually go wide, but a lot of these platforms want to suggest other books by the writer, and you'd like to keep that within something that people who like your series, are going to relate to. So that's the logic there.
Yeah. So, what about that process of creating a cover? Do you kind of leave that to Janet, or do you sit and have a skull session and then argue and not talk to each other for a week? And how does that work?
So first off, Janet is not just my graphic designer, and she does the maps too. She's a writer and she's gifted. She's got a real voice. The thing that and I have worked as a graphic designer. Janet and I, there's a lot of overlap between the things that we do and are interested in. But what's happened over time, and particularly since we left Charleston and we moved to the farm, is that we've come to understand that what I really enjoy is writing, and what she really enjoys is art, graphic art. So we're specializing now. And I think that's for the better. But how do we do it? Well, I'll tell you that with this, with the Goddess Daughter trilogy, it's how do you, there are things that we know about what sells in a genre cover. It's very important. But Janet is not a she can draw, but that's not really her forte. So she's kind of limited in that regard. And we looked at a few things, including some 3D modeling software, and she just wasn't happy with any of it. And at one point, we were sitting around the fire pit up at the top of the hill here, and I said, I just remembered that there's this old, back in the old days, people used to cut little silhouettes, and they would put those silhouettes in. They didn't have photography, so a good silhouette that went into a little pendant or a locket was a thing. But then people would also do really elaborate paper cuts. And she's like, "Whoa, I could work with that." So when you look at the covers, and I'm particularly a fan of the first one, it's basically silhouettes and backgrounds. And I think it's extremely evocative. I've had people, I think at some point, I just think it's a fantastic look for a fantasy series in that, it's not so explicitly drawn that it answers questions for you, but it absolutely evokes a feeling and a place. And they're all very appropriate to the series. My favorites are the one that, she did for Shane. I mean, I like all of them, but, and the one that she's just done for, book number 4, which is called Tanupa. And if you get a chance to look at those, what you'll see is that one is in the mountains and it's got one palette, and the other is basically set on the plains and a very different palette. I think they leave people wanting to answer the question, what's going on here? It's what you want.
Now, are both of those written under the Conover name, or?
Both of those are written under D.C. McElroy.
Mm-hmm. D.C. McElroy, got it. Okay. So what is your writing regimen? I mean, when do you write? How much do you write? How long does it take you to complete a book?
Right. So are you familiar with Cory Doctorow? Do you know who that is?
Cory Doctorow, E.L. Doctorow.
No. So Cory Doctorow is a science fiction writer, but he's most famous for being one of the founders of a pretty significant early geek blog called Boing Boing.
Okay.
Which back in, I had a whole incarnation where I was just a kind of a media tech guy, and I was a daily reader of Boing Boing. Well, anyway, he was talking about his regimen for his fiction. And he's like, what I found is that, I need to get about 4 hours a day. Sometimes I can run over, but if I get in 4 hours a day, that's, 5 or 6 days a week, I'm really making progress. Well, when I was, when I was working full time and I worked, I was a 50, 60 hour a week kind of guy at the paper. So writing those first books and the short stories that got into the anthologies and won the awards and whatnot, I had to do that and raising 4 kids. Basically, if I wanted to write fiction, I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning and do that and then go to work. So my regimen for the first few years was get up at 4:30 in the morning and write until I go to work. That worked pretty well. But what it is now is I get up in the morning and I do what I always did as a reporter or an editor, which was I read all the news. I'm a junkie. I read everything. I write about it a little bit on Facebook, which is what I do instead of blogging now. And I make us lunch, and then at about noon, I'll start writing. And I find that I write at a minimum for 4 hours. And if I'm on a roll, I just keep rolling. Usually we try to knock it off here around 5 or 6. We take the dogs out for a walk. We walk the walk around the property here on the farm. And then we just kind of have a life, you know, in the evenings. But, you know, if it's moving, I'll, you know, right until past midnight.
So how long does a book take you to complete generally, if you were to average them out?
Right. So, yeah, I wrote Tawnupa in 46 sessions. I mean, I keep track of it on a spreadsheet. Took me
46 4 hour sessions, basically
various sections, you know, lengths, right? But 46 days in which I was actually writing on the book. And you know, another goddamn novel, I wrote that in 28 days. Bokur, I wrote in just over a month. Shane took me a long time, relative to everything else, because it was the, you know, I kept having to do the brain work for the whole thing, not just the book in front of me. And it, that was the most complicated of all the heavy lifts, you know? But then once Shane was written, Lear and Guinier, the books 2 and 3 in the series, were fast and fun. So I'm, from what I gather, I'm a fast writer. but just saying that, are you familiar with the 10,000 hours theory?
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah, it's Gladwell. And I think there's a lot of, you know, whatever you feel about Gladwell, I think there's a lot of truth about that. And weirdly enough, well, I won't tell that story right now, but just I think that writing in public on a daily or weekly basis since I was 25 has basically it means that I'm very comfortable writing. I'm less comfortable when I'm not writing. So, you know, like those questions, like, you know, I enjoy having written, I hate writing. Well, I'm the other way, right? I love writing. I'm not really big on being an author. that's like a job. I would rather be doing the work. So it doesn't really surprise me that I'm faster than some other people. I'm not, I think I'm just at this point, I'm 58 years old. I've been doing this for a while, and, it just flows a little more naturally for me now than it did when I was 25.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about multiverse, because today multiverse can mean virtual reality or augmented right. reality. It can mean spirituality. It can have to do with, God didn't create one cosmos. There's just an infinite number of cosmos, cosmoses, however.
Yeah.
And then there is, of course, physics. And you did say quantum in the title. Yeah. So is it physics based? Is it any element of VR?
Absolutely.
Or is it? Okay,
no,
go ahead.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
So remember, I talked before about Patricia Anthony, the late, great Patricia Anthony. And she was, you would get on the phone with her or you know, email thread, and she's like, oh, I'm reading all this stuff about string theory. And do you understand quantum? So she wrote an entire book called The Happy Policeman, which is about aliens that come to Earth, but their physics, you know, our physics that we think in is Newtonian, right?
Mm-hmm.
Theirs is quantum. Well, we can't forget the language. We can't understand the way they think at all. It's a very frustrating book to read. And I got on the phone with her after I read it. I said, Pat, I didn't get this at all. She says, well, that's why. It's because they're thinking in quantum physics. And I'm like, okay, I'll go back and read it again. Well, then it made sense. And I, you know, we got back on the phone and I said, well, it's a really good book, but God damn it. I mean, you've written something that's a heavy lift for people to get when you don't say it explicitly. So it was kind of a running joke with me that if you just kind of wanted to black box anything in science fiction, you could kind of go, well, it's has to do with string theory or quantum physics. And of course that whole idea that there is this idea in physics, which we don't need to get into, but that the multiverse is an existing thing, that there's not just one reality, but lots of them. And every time that I've talked to a physicist about this sort of thing, and I used to do science writing, they're like, oh God, please don't talk to me about this. Right. That's you know, because the problem is that they're thinking in math, but then to describe it, they have to do it in analogies. Right. So there's this real problem in science where we need to be better as science communicators, and we all know it, but oh my God, we have to talk in analogies and then people get them all wrong. So in this one, the whole conceit is that somehow or another, there's a multiverse and someone named Dan Conover, a quantum version of Dan Conover in another plane of the multiverse has broken the multiverse. And now the whole thing is starting to collapse. So all the lines are being crossed, and I think it cracks me up when I read it. But a lot of it too was that when I was writing that, I was coming out of this really frustrating experience of having a book get recommended. So I wrote the first book that I wrote was a Darbus book, and there's a lot of yada yada, but basically the company that had been publishing my short stories, after this ridiculous delay, actually got a hold of it. And I get a call from the editor and he says, I love it. I'm recommending that this be published, that we publish this as our like third or fourth novel. And I'm like, that's great. Can't wait. Well, then he calls me back in a few days and he says, well, bad news. So we went into the meeting where I was going to do this, and we were told that everybody had been laid off and here's the new publisher, and we're only going to do novels out of the Star Wars universe. That lasted for 3 months, and then the company just went out of business. So I'd come out of that going, oh, well, that was kind of close, but no cigar. And then, it's just the frustration of not being part of the literary world and trying to query editors and publishers, really more agents after a while. And it was just, I couldn't crack it. And so I was looking at doing an ebook version and self-publishing the books that I already had in my catalog, because you know, what's the point of having something that you've written that no one else ever gets to read? Right. I wanted to get it out there. But just the experience of reading all the advice that people had for ebook publishers back in 2012, 2013, I just thought it was ridiculous and it cracked me up. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write this book that's going to have me in all these absurd situations and with interludes where I just talk about marketing, and that's the book with these little author interludes that, bring back characters from short stories and things that I've written and one in particular in this new way, just gets silly. And I really like that about that book.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about life on the farm. Hmm. You're a Black Sheep Manor, yeah. Gardens, right?
Yeah.
What kind of farming do you guys do?
Well, I always hesitate to call it farming because for all sorts of reasons, largely related to scale and the fact that I refuse to go into debt. but anyway, this was Janet's great grandfather's farm. It's up here in the South Carolina upstate in the Appalachian foothills. Spent a lot of time in the Appalachians. I'm very comfortable here. But there was no one actually living here. Her family owns this property in a trust. So Janet is a co-owner with her sisters and her father. And her father he's in his 80s, and he likes to spend as much time up here as he can. He has his own place. But it just so happened that there was a building here that was not, or a trailer here that was not being, had nobody in it. And I'd just gotten laid off from this really good gig doing marketing and commo for the Charleston Battery soccer team in Charleston, South Carolina. Great club. We had a lot of success with it. We grew the, you know, we broke the record for single season attendance and all kinds of stuff, and made them kind of cool. And it made them cool enough that a tech bro came in and bought it and ran it straight into the ground and laid everybody off. Oh. So I got laid off right in April. And so basically there was in April 2016. So there were no jobs to be had in U.S. soccer because, you know, the season had just started. Everybody was fully staffed up. And so we were just looking at each other. We had our business, Zarktopia, which is a media we still have it. It's a media services business. And we had, you know, not enough clients at that point to pay the mortgage and all the things with, you know, the kids and without that soccer income. So I'm like looking around at what to do. And at one point, Janet said, you know, we could do this. We could move up to the upstate. We could live on the farm. We could cut our costs and we could do the things that we always wanted to do. Kids are out now. We could sell our house and we could try writing and making art. And I'm like, let's do that.
And what? Grow food?
Well,
grow flowers?
So
originally some the cattle on the property.
Our original plan was that we would try whatever kind of agricultural thing fit into, you know, we would learn. And so we spent the first few months just kind of sorting that out. And we built our first garden in 2017. That was just for us. It did very well. So in 2018, we made a garden to be a commercial garden for the first time and expanded. Started thinking about it as a business and started going to the farmer's market. And the goal was to, make enough money to cover the cost of, all of our expenses for all the gardening that we did. Weren't really concerned that first year with making a profit. And, you know, we got there. And so we got bigger the next year. And the biggest year was the year that wound up being the start of the pandemic. And that killed the farmer's market. So here I am with all the produce in the world and no good way to sell it. And you might think, well, just go to the grocery store. Man, it's not that simple. I had a couple of places where I could sell produce. And we also, you know, because we grew a lot of things looking for what people would like, and what people really liked was our tomatoes. We grow fantastic tomatoes here. And so we had a few.
These are heirloom tomatoes, mostly fully genetically replete.
We grow different kinds, but the vast majority of what we grew would be considered heirlooms. And they're delicious. It's also, there's a reason why that's a bad business, which I can go into. But it's that's a difficult business because, you know, generally, if you love an heirloom tomato, the moment that it is good, that it is perfect, is a short moment. And Americans are used to buying tomatoes and setting them on the counter and letting them sit there for a week. If you do that with an heirloom, you've got a mushy tomato. Mm. So,
so you buy them daily, just like the Europeans. You go to the store daily.
That's it.
And you put it right to use.
That's
otherwise.
Right.
Otherwise, it's expired.
So we still have people. We still have people during tomato season who just show up here, even though we stopped being after the farmers market crashed. I decided I'm not doing this again. So this past year, year two of the pandemic, really, I only grew for us, which meant only, you know, on tomatoes, instead of 350 plants, 350 vines, we maybe had 110. And this year, it'll probably be a little less than that. I'm trying to find that right thing for two people. And, you know, we try to share the stuff around. Now our focus is much more on food that we can preserve. Last year, we preserved...
As in canning them and bottling them?
Yeah. So last year, we preserved 64 gallons of marinara.
Nice.
That's a lot of marinara when you can...
Yeah.
And not insignificant.
Well, you're talking to a guy who eats a lot of pasta. Ooh. So.
And let me tell you what, when you're growing your own paste tomatoes and then you're mixing heirlooms into that...
Oh, I can imagine.
Oh, it's really good.
And then put some chili pepper in there or some Calabrian peppers and really light it up.
Well, the other thing that we've found is that, I mean, I've always kind of enjoyed growing, peppers. But the thing about growing hot peppers of various kinds and chili peppers is that you can make fantastic sauce out of that. And that's a great way to save them. So, unlike a green pepper, which its use is when it's ripe, when you grow chili peppers and various hot peppers, they have lots of uses that last for years. Mm. So those are our kind of specialties. But mostly I just like having I like having greens available to us, 12 months out of the year, and grow a lot of potatoes.
Self-sufficiency, camping equipment, a farm.
Yeah.
A kerosene lantern and a quill with some ink.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're all set.
Gentleman farmer is not the right word, but
why not? I mean, you do it for pleasure. Well, maybe you don't do it for pleasure. You do it for subsistence.
It's both. But right now,
you're just not a gentleman. You're not really a gentleman.
I'm not a gentleman.
You swear like a sailor or a tank commander.
Absolutely. It's my native voice, what we've been through, and we're still going through it, is this whole sort of decluttering not just your life but your head, getting out of all the things that
it's called deprogramming.
Yeah,
that's once you leave a cult, you have to be deprogrammed.
That's right.
There's a lot of people in this country who need to be deprogrammed right now.
Yeah, and it's been wonderful, and I got to say that that for writing, if for people who are writing, if you can get to a place that might not have the luxuries that you're used to, or the material standard that you're used to, if what you're really about is finding time to do the thing that you love, that you can't not do, man, the best thing you can do is just reduce your expenses to the point where you don't have to work very much to meet expenses. And
yeah, Zen type living, minimalism. I read a blog post years ago by a woman who, it was called 101 Things. She got rid of everything but 101 things that really meant something to her. Mm-hmm. And she said she was so much happier to just get rid of that, just basically purge and not, there are people who, I just did a cover profile in the magazine I'm editor of. And the guy, he's CEO of a company. He's an entrepreneur. He started multiple companies, very successful. He says, owning things just gives me anxiety.
Yeah.
It's just, I would rather not own this stuff. All I need is, my home, my family, some food, and yada, yada. This would be a good point to end on because we're running long and I don't want to start acting like Joe Rogan here and go for 2.5 hours and smoke a joint and all that stuff to propel us.
Okay.
So, our guest has been Dan Conover, who also writes under the name D.C. McElroy or McElroy, depending on how you like to pronounce it. You like it McElroy. There it is. D.C. McElroy. Thanks a million for taking time and coming on the program. And you've really been generous with your perspectives. And I was saying at the top, you got a great voice for this. You got that sugar cured tobacco voice. It must come from living in North Carolina. You did say you were a smoker at one point, but fortunately you gave that up. But you got some good residual auditory command out of that.
Well, good.
Thanks for coming on the program.
A lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me on.